Continuing this evening in the seventh chapter of Daniel, I'm going to try and finish up the seventh chapter, and then Mickey is going to continue, God willing, next week with the eighth chapter of Daniel. As we begin this evening, David Skinner, could I ask you to direct us in prayer? Appreciate that prayer. I have studied, but like I said, the seventh chapter is difficult. And Mickey, as I remember, the red button?
Bottom
one. Okay. Okay. Oh, and Dick, I did just remember what we were talking about a few weeks ago. Yes. Okay. And then the red button to advance.
The right button to advance. The red button is the marker.
Oh, the pointer. Okay. Right button to advance. Left button to retreat. Okay. Okay, let's review a little bit. We can divide the seventh chapter of Daniel into two parts. The first half being the vision, and the second half is the interpretation of that vision. And in verses 15 and 16, we see that Daniel, we see the nature of this vision is disturbing to Daniel. He wants to know what the vision means. So he approaches one of the angels or heavenly hosts there, as we discussed last week, referencing verse 10 of chapter 7. And Daniel asks for an authoritative interpretation of the vision. And we saw how that in chapter 2, the kingdom of God was prophesied to begin during the rule of the fourth world kingdom. And we saw that in chapter 7 that the Son of Man received an everlasting kingdom. So, it's reasonable that the four beasts pictured in Daniel 7 are the four kingdoms of chapter 2. And we saw that fulfillment of these prophecies helped us verify our identification of the fourth kingdom. Jesus came to establish the kingdom. We looked at that reference in Luke. Jesus preached that the kingdom was near in the fourth chapter of Matthew. And in the ninth chapter of Mark, in verse 1, we noted where Jesus indicated that the kingdom was going to come during the lifetime of that generation. And Peter preached that God had made him Lord and Christ, Acts 2 and 36. And starting with the second chapter of Acts, from that time forward, men entered the kingdom, Colossians 1, 12 and 13. And this all took place in the reign of the Roman emperors, Luke 3 and verse 1, specifically there, Augustus. Now, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever. and ever. So, an interpretation of the vision is going to be related here to Daniel in verses 18 and 19, excuse me, in verses 17 and 18. Now, we discussed who these saints were last week. Many interpret these to be New Testament saints that Rome persecuted. And we saw how the word translated saints in Daniel 7 is Kaddish. And Daniel uses the word Kaddish 6 times in chapter 7. And that was Strong's number 6922. And we saw also, as I recall, that this word was used by Daniel and translated holy in association with holy gods in the fourth chapter and the fifth chapters of Daniel, Holy One and Holy Ones. Again, in verses 13, 17, and 23 of Daniel 4. So this word Kaddish, the use of that word doesn't demand that we're talking about New Testament saints. And we saw that the word possess, according to Strong's Hebrew and Chaldee dictionary, means to hold an occupancy. And we talked about how the saints could not occupy the kingdom until it was established, Acts chapter 2, and that once dominion and the kingdom were given to the Son of Man, verses 13 and 14 in chapter 7, once the kingdom was set up, Daniel 2 and 44, that the saints could possess or occupy a kingdom. Now, in verse 19, after this short explanation of the vision, Daniel apparently does not completely understand the meaning of the vision regarding the fourth beast. He asks for a further explanation. And Daniel is given more information needed to understand the vision. And that starts down in verse 23. And in verse 20, Daniel writes that he saw in the vision a change in or transformation of the fourth beast from 10 horns to 3 falling and finally to 1 stout horn. So Daniel wants more understanding about this transformation and the horns. And Daniel doesn't fully understand in verse 21 the horn making war against the saints and prevailing. As we saw in the fourth chapter in verse 17, Daniel understands that God's in control of the affairs and kingdoms of men. But Daniel and the people of Judah are in captivity, and this horn's going to war against the Kaddish and prevail. So what does this mean for the future of the people of Israel? Now in verse 22, Daniel sees in the vision that God would come and render a judgment in favor of the Kadesh of God, and then the Kadesh will possess a kingdom. Again, Daniel and his people are in captivity. So what does this mean about their captivity? What does it mean about the future of Israel? God's still in control. Exactly, but it's almost like Daniel, from his frame of reference, is trying to maybe understand what the larger picture is here. David?
Throughout the Israel nation, time and history, it looks like the other countries were in charge, but God's people have always had that kingdom, whether it's the Jews or the Christians later on. I mean, Pharaoh looked like he had, he killed all the 2-year-olds, all the male babies, all but the one that he needed to, and he educated him, made him a leader, which God used to bring the children of Israel out. So it looks like the other nations might, be superior or reign over the over, but it never lasts. But God's saints have always had the kingdom and always will have.
And that's going to be the message at the end of the seventh chapter, is that the saints are going to be given a kingdom. The saints are going to be victorious. The saints are going to be vindicated, if you will. David? That's a good observation. Okay, now we've gotten down to the 23rd verse. So Daniel has asked for an understanding for the truth regarding this vision. He's been given an explanation, but yet he wants a clearer, deeper understanding of this vision. And he's seen certain things in the vision that he wants a better understanding of. And now, in verse 23, he's going to be provided with a clearer or deeper understanding of the meaning of the vision. Does everyone see how the last half of this seventh chapter is organized, if I can use that word? Okay. Now, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon earth, which will be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And last week we mentioned this description of the Roman Empire, how she could never get enough of conquest, how her designs were exploitation and imperialism, by plunder and taxation. And we talked about what Rome did to Carthage and Jerusalem. Now, the So was Rome a world empire? Well, the Roman Empire came to dominate part of England, southwestern Europe, southeastern Europe, including the Balkans, the entire Mediterranean region. The Mediterranean Sea almost became a Roman lake. Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine, Egypt. And the population of the empire is estimated to have been some 70 to 100 million people. So this description of the fourth kingdom and the vision kind of seems to fit with recorded history, doesn't it? And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to see if we can reconcile or fit this vision with recorded history. Okay, and as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom shall 10 horns arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the former, and he shall put down 3 kings. So, here's the transformation. Here's the change going on with the fourth kingdom in the vision. Now again, we've established from chapters 2 and 7 that the fourth kingdom, or beast, is Rome. And from secular history, Rome was originally a republic during which, while it was a republic, it was ruled by a senate. Senators were elected by Roman citizens, but over an extended period of time, for some 400 years or better, there were political intrigues and fights, and the senators were constantly fighting for power between themselves, to the point, almost to the point of anarchy. And between 70 BC and 50 BC, 2 men, Pompey and Julius Caesar, came to prominence. They were responsible for the first triumvirate, meaning a ruling coalition, if you will, of 3 men, Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus. And it turns out that Pompey was the son-in-law of Julius Caesar. And by 48 BC, Crassus had been killed in battle, and Pompey had been assassinated. And in 45 BC, the Senate had declared Julius Caesar to be emperor of Rome for life. And in 44 BC, Caesar was murdered by members of the Senate, of course, ending his rule. And out of that came a second triumvirate, Mark Antony, Octavius, who is Augustus, and Lepidus. And from the second triumvirate, Augustus emerged in 31 BC when he defeated Mark Antony in a battle. And he emerged as a survivor of this triumvirate and ruled as emperor until his death in 14 AD. So he ruled as emperor for over 40 years. So when we looked at the history of the Roman Empire, we see how the form of government changed from a republic to a triumvirate, and evolved into a one-man rule, an emperor. So Daniel's vision pictures this evolution of Rome from a republic to an empire. So we're not trying to take any of these horns and identify them with a specific person, but just that the vision is showing something about the fourth kingdom. And that fourth kingdom, showing a characteristic of that fourth kingdom, that it's going to evolve from a republic to an empire. And that helps us identify who the fourth kingdom is. Randy?
A couple of screens back, you had Rome as a republic. You had the date 509.
Yeah. I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a small city-state country prior to then.
Because that would have been during the Assyrian Empire? Is that when Rome was established?
The origins of Rome actually go back, as if memory serves me, back to about 750 B.C. So yes, it was growing while a lot of these other eastern empires were rising and falling.
Because we established at the beginning of chapter 7 that Daniel wrote this sometime around 560 to 550 B.C. So
yeah.
Rome had not yet, I mean, you said that the beginnings of Rome had already been established at the point where
mm-hmm.
he's writing. Of course, he's writing about something that's going to happen 500 years later.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about this coalition of three men and then one man emerging. Yes, he's writing 450, 500 years prior to that happening. Exactly.
Okay. Do you think the prophecy of Rome ends at the beginning of Rome, like ends with Augustus, or does it stretch into 200 or 300 years A.D.? Because the persecution of the kingdom, the persecution of the saints, was even worse as time went on. By the time
Well, I might direct your attention to perhaps the 11th verse of the 7th chapter. It may indicate that 11th verse, as a description of the beast, may be pointing in that direction out there, to answer your question. It's possible. Now, for what are probably the two hardest verses in the entire 7th chapter to get a handle on and understand. And he shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints, and think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and half a time. But the judgment shall be set, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. Okay. Now, the horn was to wear out the saints, the Kaddish here, until the time and times and the dividing of time, but the judgment shall set. That is, the judgment has been made and it shall stand. So, this is picking up the discussion from the very end of class last week. Did Rome war against the saints? Well, the answer to that is yes. Rome warred against both New Testament and Old Testament saints. Clearly, that's recorded in history regarding New Testament saints, especially starting in about 64 BC with Nero. But what about Old Testament saints? And remember, we talked about the existence of Old Testament saints. We talked about Acts chapter 2 and verse 5. We talked about John baptizing. We talked about Jesus baptizing. And even further back than that, there were 7,000 who had not bowed their knee. And what story am I relating right there? Pardon me? Okay, Elijah. Now, let's look at some history. Now, Pompey was quite a conqueror. And probably when you read Roman history, you might begin to think that Pompey was actually out in front of Julius Caesar in terms of becoming the emperor of Rome. But Pompey intervened in 63 BC in a civil war between two brothers who are of the Hasmonean or Hasmodean dynasty from the Maccabees, I believe, ruling in Jerusalem. And this was a civil war going on in Judea. And the armies of Pompey and Hyrcanus II, laid siege to Jerusalem. After 3 months, Jerusalem fell. And Josephus records this event in Antiquitates Judaici, in book 14 and chapter 4. And he says that of the Jews there fell 12,000, but of the Romans very few. And he describes how Pompey went in to the temple and went into the Holy of Holies, because Pompey had never heard of anything, never heard of a religion that didn't have an idol, didn't have a statue. He was very curious about this and wanted to see it for himself. So there's a 3 month siege of Jerusalem where 12,000 Jews are killed. And in Acts 5:37, the story about Gamaliel giving his advice. Also recorded by Josephus that Judas of Galilee led a violent resistance to the census imposed for Roman tax purposes in Judea around AD 6. And the revolt was crushed brutally by the Romans. So yes, there were some battles some wars between Rome and Judea prior to the existence of New Testament saints. Randy?
Approximately what year was the Hyrcanus the second one that defiled the temple?
That was in 63 BC. Right. Okay. Now, probably a key to understanding what verses 25 and 26 are talking about is to try and couple the phrases a time, times, and half a time with the phrase, the judgment shall be set. In other words, when were the saints given into the hand of the fourth kingdom, or Rome? So what time period is that? And what is this judgment that's going to stand? What does one have to do with the other? Randy?
Sorry, I have some of the questions. I might ask you about that. I don't remember the details of this. Was there a year that Rome conquered the Greek Empire? Did that happen over the course of a long time? Or did the Roman army just rise up and beat the Greeks?
No. Not like that, because the Greek Empire divided into four different kingdoms based on four different generals under Alexander. Rome did come in and invade Greece, that's true. But as you can see, like in Palestine, they were kind of, which was part of the Seleucid Empire. At that time, Rome was invited in. And like I was telling Richard the other day, Rome was kind of like the dinner guest who was invited and came but never left. Yes. So, this amount of time, whatever it is, this duration of time, and this judgment, what do they have? Let's start thinking about what do they have to do with each other in the context of Daniel's vision. Before I bring up the next screen, let me suggest to you that the time, times, and half a time may represent a period of time, a duration of time that has to do with the Roman Jewish war that culminates in the destruction of Jerusalem and the judgment. What does the judgment have to do with that? The judgment is that judgment that was promised by Jesus in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. The word for time in the 25th verse here is Eden. And that's Strong's number 5732. Literally means a time of duration, and as a second meaning in there, it can mean a year. So if you add that up, a time times, plural, and a half time, that's 3.5 years. Now, as one possible explanation, from recorded history, the Roman general Vespasian received a commission and a set of orders from Nero to go down and deal with the revolt in Judea. Now, Vespasian and his legions landed in Judea . The information I have is that they landed in April of 67 AD. And interestingly enough, Josephus records in Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 10, that Jerusalem was captured in the month of Elul, being September in 70 AD. Now, when we do count that time from Vespasian's arrival in Judea, up to Jerusalem's capture, that is some 42 months or 3.5 years. But even though we've made an attempt here to try and fit recorded history with the vision, let's say that this phrase, time, times, and half a time, represents a duration of time. And that duration of time was for the Romans to crush the Jewish revolt. And that's when the saints were given into the hand of the fourth kingdom. And this ties into the phrase judgment mentioned in verse 26. The judgment that we see promised in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. This judgment was carried out, or the judgment was set, when the Roman Empire destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. And there are other verses that we can look at in Daniel, which I believe promise or foretell a judgment against Israel. In the 8th chapter, verses 23 through 26, there are verses in the 9th chapter of Daniel within the prophecy of the 70 weeks. And in the 11th chapter, towards the end of the 11th chapter, about the prophecy regarding the time of the end. Chris?
Is there a pattern that tells us that, or teaches that the time, times, and half the time teaches us to add those? Instead of those being three separate times?
Richard?
A similar pattern is used in the book of Revelation, and the description is very similar to this. In several areas, at one time mm-hmm. it will mention, as you say, the 42 months, another time it will mention 3.5 years, and another time it will mention time, times, and half time.
And it'll mention 1,260 days. Specifically, Chris, in the 11th chapter of Revelation, verses 2 and 3. In the 12th chapter of Revelation, verses 6 and 14. You'll see what Richard is talking about. You'll see 42 months, time, times, and half a time, and you'll see 1,260 days. That helps us to add those together. Now,
one problem I have with the judgment part after the time and half a times is that we already had a judgment scene once that where the Ancient of Days was sitting over and bringing judgment on these four kingdoms, and now we see this judgment scene as we're explaining what he's already seen, and it sounds to me like we're saying that it's a different judgment now.
Tommy, you're talking about where the books are opened?
Yes.
Oh.
When we open the...
Well,
I don't doubt what we say. It could be.
Yeah.
Actually, that's the way it is.
My thinking about that is that is simply to, if you will, categorize it. In other words, that the first half of the seventh chapter is simply Daniel seeing the vision, and the second half is the same vision, it's just the interpretation of that vision. So the books being opened, specifically, Tommy, I think the books being opened, if I can point to this, when the books are open, there's going to be a judgment there based on the things recorded in those books. Okay? And specifically, while we see in Acts and Hebrews 13 that the Jews were keeping the old law, with the destruction of the temple, from 70 AD forward, it would be impossible to keep the old law. There was no temple, and the genealogies were destroyed. Nobody knows who's from the tribe of Levi anymore. But that the prophets, the apostles, and saints, whom Jerusalem rejected, were now vindicated. Luke 21:22, because these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But I got ahead of myself a little bit there. Okay. 5 minutes?
Yep.
Okay. Maybe I will wind this up. Mickey? Yes. Yes. This is not the last time you're going to see a judgment scene. Right. But the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints most high. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Now, and this is kind of going back to some of your questions earlier, Randy, that the everlasting kingdom and dominion were given to the saints. In other words, Daniel, this is what's going to happen to your people, to the holy ones. They're going to be given a kingdom and dominion so that all powers would serve and obey God. These saints have been given, if you will, Randy, a new Jerusalem, Galatians 4:26. The old law was taken away. Where's my pointer? The old law was taken away with the death of Christ. We can read about that in these verses, in this scripture in the New Testament. Galatians, Ephesians, Colossians, and the 10th chapter of Hebrews. All of that happened prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. All of that happened with the death of Christ. But we see in Acts, you know, we see Paul being followed over half of the, throughout half of the Roman world, literally, by Jews who are trying to persecute him. I believe in Hebrews 13 we have a description there of priests going in and out of the temple. The temple is still in existence at the time the book of Hebrews was written. But with the destruction of Jerusalem, it's now physically impossible to keep the old law. The temple is gone. There are no genealogies. No one knows who is of the tribe of Levi. There is no priesthood. Old Israel's dominion is finished. The saints are part of a new kingdom. Given to the saints of the Most High, an everlasting kingdom. Where do we find that in Hebrews? In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28. Daryl? I didn't get that last part. I'm sorry. Right. Eventually, that kind of institutional memory is lost. For instance, no one today can prove that they're from the tribe of Levi.
Well, I know that. What I'm saying is, it wouldn't have been immediate.
No, not a. It wouldn't have been
yeah.
1 year after that.
Yeah, if you were but, a biblical priest and I was mm-hmm. in the temple, I would know you even though the temple was destroyed.
Right.
But if they're commanded to worship in the temple, right. then that would effectively stop fulfilling the complete old law. But as far as having the memory of who was from what tribe, that would take a while.
That would take a while, but the temple was destroyed.
Right.
So, Daniel, the saints in the end are going to be victorious. They're going to be vindicated. They're going to be given a kingdom. That's what's going to happen to the holy ones. Thank you.
I'm trying to get in here, but anyway, I have an idea about this that is completely different than what you're saying here. Obviously, we don't have time to talk about it now, but one that is much more simplified than that. And so, if we have time next week, I'd like to bring it up.
You'll have to talk to the professor. Thank you very much. Yeah.